Consumer is fair and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 791. And who are the attorneys? Sean, are you ready? Come on up. Welcome, please introduce yourself and start.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I represent the Independent Electrical Contractors of Oregon. Before you today, we have Senate Bill 791. A few weeks ago, we had addressed Senate Bill 636, which we talked about both of these bills at that hearing, dealing with the family member issue, being able to bring your son or daughter into your own business in the apprenticeship program, and then secondly, the 6 months of prior employment by an employer. We have been working the last few weeks on language that you have seen in the at the first hearing, where we've worked with Boley on satisfying some EEOC concerns, those concerns being that we would that there would be no adverse impact on apprenticeship opportunities for members of any race, sex, or ethnic group, and that the council shall approve and allow employers to bring in their either sons or daughters or their previous employees. And as we discussed it and have talked about this issue the last few weeks with our electrical contractors and some of the other members of the other JATCs, we felt that to make the bill cleaner, that we would address the six-month issue because it actually would encompass the family members within the six-month issue. Most employers that we talk to do hire their sons or daughters and have been not just 6 months, but have been working for the company for several years. And so it would actually satisfy the family member issue. And that's what the Dash 1 Amendments to 791 address. And we would answer any questions. Bob Bockhoffner on my left here to answer any questions as well. Urge the committee to adopt the Dash 1 amendments and pass Senate Bill 791.
We have Jack. Do you want to testify on this one, sir?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the Commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industries. And we did have people from our agency work to help develop this language. We don't oppose this amendment, provided it is understood how we interpret it, and we believe that it would be enforced by the Apprenticeship Council and by the Apprenticeship Training Division. And that is that under sub 1 of Section 2, where it says that a committee may allow an employer to hire an existing employee, if the applicant is otherwise eligible to enter the apprenticeship program, we do not interpret that simply to mean they've met the initial eligibility to apply, but that if there is any form of list or ranking, that they've worked up the position where they're eligible to be selected by a committee. And that in this case, we're recognizing that the committee will allow the employer, the current employer, to then hire that person. It is not our interpretation here that this allows a current employee to be chosen ahead of other people on the ranking list or in the time order. It doesn't, in other words, move anyone to the front of the line, and that if it were to be used in that way, that that would almost certainly result in an adverse impact on opportunities based on race, sex, or ethnic group. That's how we believe this would be interpreted by the council, and want to make sure that's understood. If this bill goes forward and is enacted into law and is signed by the governor, we don't then want people to say, we didn't know it was going to work this way. So on the record, that we do not mean by this that just because someone is a current employer, has been employed for 6 months, you can then move them to the front of the line. But it does mean that the current employer gets the first claim to that person when that person becomes eligible to be selected by program.
Any comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, actually, John Engie from the Apprenticeship Training, or the Apprenticeship Coalition would like to, he's had several conversations with Steve Sims and Jack. We can talk through this, and John, Bob can also answer some of those questions.
Okay. Welcome, John. Please introduce yourself for the record.
For the record, my name is John Engie.
I am co-chair of the Apprenticeship Coalition, which is an organization of union and non-union JATCs, local joint committees, who have come together in the interest of trying to create a better training model for apprenticeship. We represent about 3,000 apprentices. We don't represent the apprentices, but we represent the training function of 3,000 apprentices and roughly 40 committees. We've worked closely on this particular issue, and it is, I guess I would have to say that I feel that the way the law is written, the way the proposed amendments are presented, the clear concept of the formers of this is that they would have preference with respect to a hiring order, and that subsection 2 would not limit that, but would only be a statement of other minimum requirements. Minimum requirements being things like GED or high school diploma, some certain other studies and minimum requirements. And that's all that's intended. And that's all the framers of that amendment intended. What I will say is that there are a number of committees that have approved training selection methods that have this almost this identical concept as an exception. It's called an exception to the selection method. And the long and the short of it is that an individual employer would be able to promote to positions of apprenticeship their regular full-time employees, providing them that the minimum requirements. Jack?
Sure, again for record, Jack Roberts. It is true that we have allowed a lot of different selection methods to be used as exceptions as we're going through this transition period to check and see what's working. Our concern is writing as a matter of law that they're entitled to use a system that we believe restores the problems that we had with the selection method that we eliminated, that the federal court in California declared was discriminatory per se. And I think that our problem with this is that it allows a selection method that gives people a chance to, in effect, exercise their this option to bring people into the back door while other people are waiting their turn patiently in line. Now, I understand the argument that we should simply wait and see what the numbers look like to see whether you have, quote-unquote, enough women and minorities in that system so that it all works out okay. I have a problem with that for a lot of reasons, not the least of which is that in Oregon and in the construction trades, which is where most of these are, it is very difficult to have numbers that, quote-unquote, look right. And when the EEOC comes in and looks at our numbers, we often are very underrepresented in terms of women and often very underrepresented in terms of many minorities. I don't believe that's because there's affirmative discrimination that's going on in many cases. It's because it's very difficult to attract women and minorities in a state our size and with the small minority population we have, and with the fact that construction trades are not terribly attractive to most women, and that if we try to rely on the numbers, we're not giving people much of an opportunity to succeed. If we can show that we have a fair and objective system that treats everyone fairly, then we can let the numbers fall where they may. And we can defend our system because there are no discriminatory elements in it. And I think that in the state, with our racial composition, and with we're talking about industries and trades that have a long history of not being particularly attractive to or welcoming to women, that if we try to play the numbers game and allow this type of a system for a selection method, our programs are going to continue to be vulnerable to challenge by the EEOC and otherwise. And that's why we have put so much of our effort into trying to have almost fail-safe selection methods that can stand up under any scrutiny, so that then even if the numbers don't, quote, look right to someone, we can defend our system as fair and non-discriminatory.
For the record again, John Eggie. I guess the my problem with this scenario is that what we have right now is a number of really qualified training agents who are saying, you know, I've participated in this in the past, but it's become too burdensome. If I can't have the ability to select my own employees and then given some time, be able to promote them to positions of apprenticeship, then I'm going to let the other person do the training. So if we then reduce the total number of trainees in particular trades or occupations, but we raise the number of females and apprentices as a percentage of the whole, what have we accomplished? And I guess that's one of the root elements of our proposal here, is that if the legislature gives us a chance to prove that we can maintain the kinds of numbers of females and minorities, then my question would be, whom are we harming? If we are just harming the federal government, I'm not terribly concerned about that, because I think we can make the case, long haul, that this is a viable option to what's on the ground now.
So you're not concerned about the federal requirements or the discrimination per se?
For the record, Chair Nelson, it's not that I'm not concerned about the federal government's oversight, but some of the numbers that the federal government uses and some of the methods that the federal government uses to get to compliance are really unrealistic. And I think that if we have the numbers and are able to generate the numbers and the kinds of effort, because really the EOC talks about effort, not about end numbers, but if we can produce the end numbers and the effort, then I don't think that they will look at our program at all. Now, that's a plumber's viewpoint, and possibly somewhat suspect, but I tend to be of a fairly practical nature. Plumbing is a practical business, and so that makes me practical by nature. And what I'm after is results. I want the most opportunities for businesses and for prospective apprentices that can possibly be generated. And I think within that, we will be able to effectively compare very well to any other selection method that is currently on the books.
Josh.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the fact that John has worked hard on this and he is committed. But it's also true that his committee is the one that the EEOC came down on not too long ago, and that has led us to take this very seriously, because they did look at selective methods and looked at the numbers. And I guess I would reiterate my initial testimony. As it is written, we're not necessarily opposed to this, but we want John and everybody else to know that both the language here about what is otherwise eligible and that initial sentence that says, to the extent that the State Apprenticeship and Training Council determines there would be no adverse impact on apprenticeship opportunities for members of any race, sex, or ethnic group, we're going to continue to look at those, and I believe that means that we will continue to apply the same criteria that we are currently applying to those programs that we allow to use this method as it is. So I think, again, if I can interpret this as saying that we're going to authorize you, or actually we're going to require you, to continue to do what you're already doing, we're okay with that. If this is advertised as a subterfuge to allow people to bring people in and move them to the front of the line in a way that adversely impacts opportunities, fair opportunities for everyone else, then they're going to have problems with us. But I don't think that, again, the way this is written, we have a problem with that.
Okay. Very large. Thank you, Mr. Jack. Just sort of reading through this here, I assume when we're talking about the Apprenticeship Council making the determination, we're really talking about the people who staff the Apprenticeship Council making a recommendation to them, which means we're back to Bowley, effectively, and it's to the extent that Bowley can determine if there would be no adverse impact. How easy is that to do? And I would think that maybe it's kind of hard to do.
Chairman Sindermeyer, first of all, while I believe that our staff is well respected by the council, I do think that the council also takes very seriously its responsibility, so I wouldn't want to suggest that they're going to rubber stamp determinations by the Bowley staff. We have a 10-member council. They're chosen from labor management and public at large. We have a very good council now, and I do think, and we also have subcommittees to work on that, so I do think there will be some scrutiny there, but yes, our staff will be involved. We now, and it's for the first, since I've been here, we started doing it for the first time in many years, are doing compliance reviews, looking at what the makeup of the population is, for women and minorities, looking at what the goals that they set for themselves were, how close they're coming to meeting those goals. There are some ways to evaluate their progress. And where we've granted exceptions, then it's often necessary to look if you're coming close to meeting those goals, maybe the exceptions can continue. If not, maybe some of the exceptions need to be withdrawn. This is how we do it here. I won't tell you that we have a foolproof way of enforcing compliance with EEO or any other requirements. We do believe that it is not simply an empty statement that says, unless we determine there's an adverse impact. We believe that we can scrutinize that. The question is ultimately whose discretion is it going to be to make that determination. We believe the discretion lies with the council, and we believe that absent a determination by our council that these exceptions are justified or that they are not having an adverse impact, we retain the right to withdraw the exceptions. Now, the question is whether this would continue to be viewed as an exception or whether this now is a statutorily approved selection method that we have a special burden to prove that they're not meeting that, and we have to go to court or in some other enforcement mechanism to establish that. And if I believe that was the case, that would concern me, and maybe that's something that we need to review more fully. My statement of non-opposition to this is based on my expectation that the council would still be the primary party making the determination as to whether or not a particular committee, using this method or any other exception to the normal methods, would be having an adverse impact. And we do have some statistical means that we use for trying to evaluate that.
Sure, if I can follow up on that. Just reading the language, I haven't thought much about this, because the council makes the determination. It almost implies that you almost have to do an affirmative action review if you're presented with a request to do by one of the friendship councils that they want to do it this way or something. You have to make an affirmative decision. You, the council, have to make an affirmative decision that it will not have an impact.
Mr. Sundermeyer, yes. In the first place, the selection method has to be approved by the council. And I would again emphasize a lot of these work is really done in subcommittees, but the subcommittees of the council, and the final action is approved by the council. So the council initially approves the selection method. And even if someone is selecting a method that is already standard, they report to us, they tell us what method they're using. We make that decision, and then we try annually, and we have now gotten on a schedule of annually doing compliance reviews. That includes how you're doing with your EEOC. And that's where I say there's a little bit of a tension in the system. On the one hand, there's the numbers game, where you're seeing how your numbers are. With small committees, and particularly you have a small minority population in many parts of the state. In fact, by the standards of many states, we have a small minority population everywhere in our state. And so trying to meet those particular numerical objectives is often difficult. And trying to meet the standards for women in the trades is a constant battle that we continue to fight to try to make sure that people are having adequate outreach and adequate opportunity, while recognizing that the choice of whether to go into the trades or not is the individual choice by that person. A lesser percentage of women choose to go into the trade than go into other occupations. That's their decision, provided we know there's a fair, open, non-discriminatory system. So the question of approving the method up front and overseeing it on a regular basis, we're already doing that. And I think the question that comes up here is where the council determines that there is a problem. On whom is the burden? Is the burden placed to make the determination that this system it has an adverse impact on the apprenticeship opportunities for the members of particular race, sex, or ethnic group? And we believe that initially the council ought to have the burden of showing that there is an adverse impact, but that the judgment of the council ought to be afforded a high deference and respect, and that we don't make the courts the decision maker in every case as to what the selection method should be.
Chair Nelson?
Yes.
Senator Beyer, if I could respond briefly to that. It's the intention of the framers of this that decision would not be prospective, that it would be retrospective. In other words, given the checkered history of Bowley with respect to being able to really make any significant progress in this particular area, it seems to me like it's time for some experimentation. The idea is then that committees will be able to do this
unless the division or the council were able to demonstrate clearly that there would be prospectively an adverse impact. But it's our feeling that if we are given a chance, that if you get to a point where you can look at it retrospectively, that that's a much better evaluation. In other words, we could all sit around and speculate and come up with a whole number of different answers about whether or not this might or might not have an adverse impact, and a lot of it would have to do with a committee's particular efforts and how serious they were about having females and minorities into the system, carrot and stick kind of approach. But with due respect, the commissioner's scenario is all about stick and very little about carrot. And what we're trying to do is inject a little of the carrot into the formula.
Yes, sir. John, if that's your intent, I think you got the wrong language. Because this one, I think you'd want to do it differently and say that the training committee shall be allowed to do this unless the state council determines that it has an adverse effect. The way the language is stated here, it requires, linguistically, it requires an affirmative decision up before you can do it. I mean, that's just the way you have it. I'm not arguing one way or another, and that's the way you've got the language in the amendment, is you're requiring that, and if your intent is otherwise, this ain't going to get you there.
Chair Nelson, Senator Beyer, let's change it.
Any questions? Senator Nelson.
Chair, you mentioned that you have statistics available to help you in determining adverse effects. And so, under the language of the dash one, where it says the training council determines it, assuming that they determine there will be no adverse impact, I mean, it seems to me that it's not that large of a leap to assume that the language would work, or it certainly would seem to me that if you have that information available to evaluate whether it's doing what it's supposed to do, that the department would have that.
Mr. Director, that's right. That's why I say that as I read this, I do believe, in fact, that this will work for the reasons Senator Beyer pointed out and for the same reasons that Mr. Eggie now maybe doesn't like his own language, because I think that this does give us the tools we need to have. And my reason for wanting to put this on the record is so if we get this bill all the way through and it's enacted, I don't want people to come back later and say, gosh, we got snookered. This isn't doing what we thought. We thought we had a right to come in and use this system, and the burden was entirely on you to come back and change it after the fact. And again, I understand that there are people who think that we have been heavy-headed in this regard. I don't believe the facts bear that out. I think we have tried to show tremendous flexibility, and that the checkered history, I think, with BOLI is that back not too many years ago, we were doing virtually nothing in this regard, and that now we are trying to do something. We have a fairly short track record so far. We're still working through it. We are trying to experiment. All I want to do is make sure that we don't do something that sets us all up for failure or for legal challenges from EEOC or, frankly, to work real hard on a bill that goes to the governor's desk and gets veto.
Okay. Any further questions? Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On line four of the dash one, where it says members of any race, sex, or ethnic group, who'd you leave out? You say anybody. I mean, you basically have everyone covered, and my thought is that anyone whom is bumped in this process has got a gripe.
Mr. Senator Miller, again, my reading of this is not that you have to meet any particular numerical quota. The question is whether the system has an adverse impact, and in that case, I'm reading adverse impact as meaning an unfair impact, where you're not getting the chance you should have received. And in that regard, if it is an adverse impact on men, or on whites, or on European descent individuals, that's also unlawful, not only in this system, but probably under the latest U.S. Supreme Court decisions, that we don't want to have an adverse impact on it. We want to make sure that this system is not used to tip the scales of the balance one way or the other.
Well, this language would clearly achieve that, because both, I'm no Bill Clinton, so I just read it in plain language here, but it says no adverse impact, which I gather means no adverse impact. And if you've got any race, sex, or ethnic group, it's pretty much anybody who has a complaint, they come see you and it's justified.
Mr. Chairman, the only part of that statement I would disagree with is that any complaint would be justified. That's where we come in. We have to decide whether this selection method has an adverse impact on one group or another. If it is simply a way to make it a fair opportunity for current employees to continue to work for their employer, and that's used fairly and non-discriminatorily, regardless of race, sex, or ethnic background, then we have no problem with this system.
But Mr. Chairman, you're reading this not as an individual, but as a whole group. That's not, I don't necessarily read it that way, but maybe that's how you interpret it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, I think that's what we're saying, is that there would be no adverse impact on apprenticeship opportunities. No adverse impact on apprenticeship opportunities
for
members of any race, sex, or ethnic group. That no race, sex, or ethnic group would have their opportunities diminished because the system is being used. But it's a fair shake for everybody, regardless of race, sex, or ethnic group.
I'm going to suggest to you that I'm not sure if I can identify someone who doesn't qualify in one of those groups.
Chairman, if there is anybody who doesn't qualify, then we didn't do a good job. We meant to cover everybody.
But I see it as an individual, not as a group.
Mr. Chairman, in a sense, you're right. If one person says, I'm being denied an opportunity, and then I was going to say, because of my race, my sex, or my ethnic group, because you're using the system, then that's unfair. And maybe the language could be more precise in saying that no adverse impact on apprenticeship for because of a membership in a race. But frankly, I think in terms of the problems that we're likely to have with this, and I certainly am not oblivious to the fact that there are likely to be problems, that's probably not going to be the one. It's going to be the showing that there is an adverse impact, what we believe there is one.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, for the record, what we attempted to do here was mirror the federal language. Once in a while, we make a mistake when we do that, but the idea is that if the feds really have ultimate authority over this, we wanted to be as close as we could to the federal language. So that was our intent. I guess what I would add one thing in closing, and that is that our hope in the coalition is that we get back to training plumbers and electricians, and that this isn't all about affirmative action. It's about training a quality workforce. And we feel that things have been skewed a little bit towards the affirmative action, kind of affirmative action uber alles. And we're a little concerned about that. Bob, please introduce yourself.
Bob Bockhoffner, Chairman Nelson and committee. One of the things that we have in place right now, if you take and you do it Bully wants to do, in other words, have no preference for those people as in number one there that are employees. That's exactly the system we have, and now we heard testimony here a few weeks ago about the family bill, and that's exactly what we're talking about. You would have if what Mr. Roberts was talking about, and you had no advantage, in other words, for a person that worked for you, you would go onto a list or a pool of several hundred people, or who knows how many. But right now, and I'll only use my experience with what they call Area 1, which is the Portland metro area in Southwest Washington, and that is that right now they have a pool of eligibles of somewhere around 175 people that qualify for the apprenticeship program. And as you qualify, you're put on there and you're drawn out as just like a lottery, and that's exactly what it is. You're drawn out and you're hired according to that pool. As you're hired, there's not all those people that are actually able to be hired into the apprenticeship program because there's far more people than are available, and or lose interest because of the time frame that they actually decided that they wanted to enter that program and the time that they actually didn't. And when we testified about the family portion of this, what we were talking about was being able to have a family member that works for you, and we relate that to employees that have worked for you having a leg up getting into the program and or be able to get into the program without any adverse effects as far as equal opportunities are concerned. In fact, I can't speak for the plumbers. I can only speak just what I know about. The Independent Electrical Contractors of the United States, we have actually formed a school in Washington, D.C., actually in Virginia, and we actually are taking all of the it's a school specifically for minorities to get them into the trades and or any apprenticeship program. And we're talking about taking that extra step, going that extra mile, feeling that it's our responsibility as business people in the community to give back to the community those people that are qualified to be in those trades. And if we don't have those minorities that are qualified, get them qualified. So I think that we're already moving ahead. I feel that the bully would limit us to our ability to continue doing that and still having the ability to hire the son, the daughter, and or the good employee that's been with you for 6 months or further.
Right.
Thank you.
Right. We'll probably have a discussion here. We'll close the public hearing unless somebody has a compelling reason to. And we'll open up the work session on Senate Bill 791. The chair would move the dash one amendment. Comment? Any objections? So ordered. The chair would move the Senate Bill 791 as amended to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Comment? Objections? So ordered. Carrier. I guess I can carry it. Somebody's jumping for it.
You have to go, I'm not sure what it says.
You're all going to public hearing here in the work session, excuse me, on Senate Bill 587, Joe Brewer. Senator Breyer. Gentlemen, welcome. Hello, House Amendments.
You do. Mr. Chair, you have two sets in front of you, the dash 2 and the dash 3. Cast aside the dash 2, they've been replaced by the dash 3. What I'd like to do is just basically introduce us and let Joe walk us through the dash 3s and say that the last time this was up in public hearing, we talked about the intent of the bill and what we were trying to do in the work groups that we had. We've had about four meetings with different groups. I apologize for sort of just getting the amendments back because, you know, LP is somewhat backed up. In fact, we got the dash 2s day before yesterday and got input from most of the groups that had an interest, and I think we've got most of those changes into there. I can't say that necessarily all the technical issues haven't been resolved, but I think, in general, most of the issues or concerns that people had have been addressed. And with that, I'll let Joe walk you through the dash 3.
Thank you, Senator Barr. Good afternoon, Senator Nelson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Joe Brewer, the administrator of the Building Codes Division. Senator Byers' characterization of the work groups, I believe, is very accurate. I've been asked to try and walk you through the dash 3 amendments. I'm going to ask you to bear with me because they're relatively new to me as well. So we'll be learning as we go. Page 1, lines 1 through 9, basically I understand these to be editorial changes. The first major change is on line 9 and 10, basically clarifying that this bill is not intended to require licensing for inspectors or plan reviewers that work for municipalities. That, in fact, we're only looking to license individuals who work for an independent third-party provider. The next significant change is 12 and 13, deleting the reference to the general fund, and then on 14 and 15, speaking to the appropriate specialty code account within the division and the department. Sub 3, starting on line 17, speaks to fees charged by hourly individuals. This is where the department captures its surcharge for the work that will now be done by licensed third-party providers as opposed to the municipal programs.
Moving to page 2, lines 1 through 6 basically go through the process of inserting language again to clarify that we're only speaking to licensed inspectors, licensed plan reviewers, again, not certified, making the distinction between certification to work for a municipal employer, licensing to work for a private third party. Section 10 is basically the funding mechanism, setting up a loan from the DCBS fund and laying out the process for payment, repayment of that loan that's currently in statute. I'm assuming, Mr. Chairman, that you and the members of the committee will stop me if you have questions. I'm on a roll here. Moving down the lines 22 through 29, again, editorial changes. Line 30 speaks again to the fact that we're not intending to impact certified licensed and certified inspectors and plan reviewers. To the top of page 3, some editorial changes speaking to the same issue. The significant item on lines 5 and 6 speaks to the outcome for a jurisdiction that fails to substantially comply with the provisions of this act, basically allowing the department to assume temporary operation of that program if the municipal program is not following, again, the requirements of the act. Moving down to line 14, again, this language is basically cleaning up the funding language, deleting references to accounts that no longer will be necessary. Section 22, starting on line 19, lays out a uniform, requires the division, the department, to lay out a uniform process for performing specialty code plan reviews, defining simple commercial, complex commercial construction projects. Sub C speaks to the development of an expedited process for a complex commercial plan review. Again, no time frames are laid out here. What's intended is that the department will work with the municipalities, and the industry to define those terms and lay out what is a reasonable process for expediting those complex projects. Sub D speaks to the development of inspection standards that reflect regional needs. It's become very apparent that the needs of the Tri-County area as opposed to Central Oregon, Eastern Oregon, may be very different from the standpoint of the code administration aspect. So this will allow the division to work on some of those issues. Sub E, development of standard application forms, procedures, time frames for issuing building permits, and recording inspections. The industry was very much interested in continuity between the operations of jurisdictions. That's a time problem for the industry, and they were interested in seeing that addressed. Sub F, develop standard forms and procedures for reviewing building plans. Sub G, a standardized criteria and method for determining fee amounts, top of page 4, for permits that are required under the state building code. Moving to section 23, this lays out the time frames for plan review required of municipal programs. The municipal programs will retain the position of gatekeeper, as it were, for the plan review and inspection process, so that if a 1- and 2-family dwelling plan is reviewed within 10 days or a simple commercial plan is reviewed within 15 days, that work all stays within the municipal program. If those deadlines can't be met, then the municipal program will be required to give the applicant a list of licensed third-party providers or give them the opportunity to go directly to a third-party provider for plan review. Sub 3, the municipality may allow an applicant to seek a plan review by a person licensed directly. There's nothing in this section that would require require the municipality to deal with the applicant. They could simply send them on to a third-party provider. Section 24 basically lays out the dedicated funding for building inspection programs. Again, that's been an issue of great interest to the industry, that fees collected for this activity be used for these purposes. Section 25 lays out a requirement for full service to be provided. Currently, a building inspection program covers many different areas. A jurisdiction might choose to perform only electrical inspections. My understanding of this section is that full service would be required. So that if a program, the municipality wanted to assume the program, it would be all the programs offered by the code. Moving on to page 5, section 26. This section lays out a statewide minor label program, very similar to the regional minor label program spoken to in Senate Bill 512, so that labels sold would be, you'd be able to use those labels anywhere in the state, as well as expanding some of the opportunities for using minor labels. Section 27 implements in the area of the structural code a concept that's been very successful in the electrical and plumbing area. That's the concept of a chief inspector. The chief inspector renders statewide interpretations. The language used in this section is, if the appropriate board determines that a decision by the chief inspector is a major code interpretation, then that major code interpretation would be distributed statewide. Major code interpretation is one that affects more than one job site, so that if it has far-reaching applications, it would be distributed statewide. The chief would also provide a level of appeal before the issue goes to the board or to the courts, so that an individual could appeal to the chief if there were disagreement around the code interpretation at the local level, and hopefully that would expedite the current process, which requires those appeals to be given to the board. Section 28 is modified again to give the division, the department, the ability to collect surcharges on the hourly work done by third-party providers, so that the division's funded and everyone's basically on a level playing field, and it wouldn't be a fiscal advantage for the third-party provider. That is a very brief summary based on approximately a half an hour of analysis of the amendment. I'd be happy to take any questions, as long as they're simple. If they're complex, I'll pass them on to the center of the fire.
Good luck on the other way. Any comments, any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Let's see. James Cummings and Bill Croft, would you like to comment on anything? Hey, why don't you just stick there close, because if you want to, you want to come back up, however you want to. Welcome, Jane. Please introduce yourself.
I will. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. I'm Jane Cummins from Oregon City. I'm going to make brief comments and then ask Bill Cross and building officials, if need be, to get into the technicalities. I'm not as familiar with some of them as they are. This is a bill which the League, as you know, Mr. Chair and members, had. We had great concerns about it when it was originally drafted, and we did take part in the work group. We do not agree with some of the directions that that work group and members of that work group wished to take, and we still have some major concerns with the bill. And though I have not had time to go through the Dash 3 amendments in any detail, there are some basics in the bill which still mean that the League would have to oppose 587. One of those sections, for instance, which is a key issue for us, is Section 6. That's in the original bill. It remains in the amended. This would allow DCBS to adopt and apply two fee schedules, one that applies to all inspections and plan reviews that municipalities make, and that fee schedule will reflect the maximum fee. And the second would be setting the fee for the administrative costs when a municipality does the inspections, when the inspections and plan reviews are done by the third party. This is setting maximum fees for cities, and we would oppose that that's part of the bill and a bill that contained that. Moving along through here, I guess I'd just highlight a few of the basic problems that we have with it. The fee issue certainly is one for us. It was mentioned that dedication of fees has been an issue for some time. Over the last three sessions, we probably have more language around the issue of dedication interspersed through this. The statutes that deal with building codes that I'm going to defy anyone to understand exactly what we do with fees. However, if there's a way that we can have some clear direction from building codes on how fee increases should be made, that certainly would be helpful. And if there is language that says that you can take the fees, except for those collected from electrical fees, and put them in one pot, that is, not take and segregate each and every segment, that would also be a help. Because as I understand it from building officials, the mechanical fees are so low, if it had to be by itself, you'd see huge, huge increases. We just had an explanation that BCD would develop inspection standards that reflect regional needs, and he mentioned the Portland area or the Tri-County area seems to be different. I think we would like to have more discussion on really what does that mean. We have a statewide code, and inspection standards could be lots of things. This could be fairly broad. And I think some of my comments really get at, it seems to me that this is a work in progress. But I don't think we're at some place where we know where we've what we've done. It's mentioned in Section 25 that a municipality that administers any part has to administer it all. And Mr. Brewer mentioned that that means that you have to take the plumbing and the electrical along with structural mechanical. If it's under ORF 455150, I'd have to check, but I think that includes some other aspects and would have to check that to see what all that means. But today and in the past, we have said that it is very difficult for municipalities to assume all of the programs and become a full-service provider. Now, that may be exactly what some folks want, that is to exclude municipalities, because we do have ideas that only the very largest should have any kind of a program. However, we strongly feel, and I think the framework that's been developed in the state is that we have a statewide code that is administered locally. And in the past, we've worked with the Building Codes Division on trying to get the Building Codes Division themselves out of the inspection service and to get that service to the local area. I think they're fully aware that we have some major problems revolving around certification, revolving around issues of why in smaller communities do we have to have three people doing inspections when we could cross-certify as they've done in other states. It would save everyone a lot of money. We are not there yet. We've even had hearings postponed or canceled where we had hoped to see some flexibility created. So it would be great if there was the ability to do this or if the way to get there was provided, but this bill does not speak to that, does not take up that at all, and that on that alone, the league would have to oppose it.
Okay. Thank you. Bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here representing the Oregon Building Officials Association. We just obviously have been trying to review the Dash 3 amendments. We did get the Dash 2, and earlier this morning reviewed those, and both sets of amendments but have raised some concerns. Dash 3, I think, has tried to address several that we were able to talk to Senator Pryor about yesterday when we first kind of looked at it. And I guess I would echo the comment that we think it's a work in progress. The work group that worked with the senator on identifying some concepts hasn't met to review the actual now printed language, and we're not comfortable with, I guess, some of the language in here and whether it will really get to what everybody thought it may have. And, for example, one of the issues was the schedule of fees, and we thought there was an agreement that the fees would be deemed reasonable, or, you know, there should be methodology and a determination that fees are reasonable and necessary to support the program, and if you're using a third-party contractor to do plan review or inspections, obviously the jurisdiction is not doing that portion and wouldn't be able to charge fees for it, but to actually have BCD establish those fees for jurisdictions large and small around the state where we have different costs, that is a concern. Some think Jane Cummins did identify some of the other areas where we're either concerned or have questions, and not maybe that, we're, that at least some of our building officials aren't necessarily opposed to, but were kind of concerned how it would actually work. And for example, in Section 23, where it says approve or disapprove a one and two family dwelling plan within 10 days, I think it was our understanding that there would be the opportunity for a contractor to go to a third-party plan reviewer, for example, if, in fact, the jurisdiction isn't able to meet those timelines. And so rather than necessarily jurisdiction, you know, accepting it and either approving it or disapproving it within 10 days, and then you go to a third party, that there be, I guess, a better guideline or a plan that says, wait, if you're not able to do that in 10 days, and we've got an example in Marion County, which, you know, has how many days, you know, they can tell you the day you go in and file for your permit, gee, it's going to be 10 days, or if it's higher, then you can just go to a third-party contractor. We're just not sure how, if this language gets to where everybody thinks wants it to get to. We're also troubled by, in reviewing the actual language, whether or not special inspectors are included in this. And there are, the codes recognize what are called special inspectors who work for testing labs and agencies and who actually will work for the owner of a building project, and, you know, they'll be inspecting the concrete as it's poured. And it appears that they would be under the licensure laws, I mean, the licensure provisions, and there again, we're not sure that that is what sponsors are intending. That will be bringing in a whole new category of individuals that we really haven't addressed. Another concern we had was we aren't sure what regional standards, inspection standards do mean, and that's just a question, but we are concerned about ensuring that as much as possible we're following a statewide application of inspection requirements. And I guess another issue is the local appeal, or the appeal process outlined here precludes a local appeal option. It says you shall, and there are some jurisdictions where it may be that the contractor would prefer starting at local because it may happen that they can get a speedier response locally when they're out there in the field on an inspection, an interpretation that they're not satisfied with. And we certainly don't, I mean, we're not, if it says they have to go straight to the state, that may be fine, but here again, it was something that as a group we didn't really discuss that. And I know, you know, there are some jurisdictions, the city of Portland, for example, that has different, they get a lot of use of their appeals process because it's very, very timely. So I guess these are just some issues that we're raising and would like to continue to work with the senator and other you know, groups in that work group to see if we can't ensure that the language does what I think many of us, not maybe all of us, agree on all concepts, but could ensure that at least the concepts are, you know, function the way I think many of the players expect them to. And I've probably missed a couple things because, frankly, we've been trying to scramble here and identify some areas that, you know, when you compare the draft to what we're going to talk about.
Senator Beyer, do you want to respond to any of all this?
Mr. Chair, I think a lot of this is, in fairness, is just newness to them as it is to me. And it's sort of that natural process that happens when you get towards the end of the term. The nice thing about working with work groups is you get everybody around the table and you tend to agree. The bad thing is it takes a lot of time. When you get to the end of the process, it's kind of
slows it down a bit. I guess there are a couple of things. I think that as I was listening to Mr. Cross discuss a lot of the points that he was concerned about, I think are addressed in there. The language is not perfect. There's a couple of things that we could do. If the committee feels that it's worthwhile to pursue this, I would be willing to sort of one more time go back and meet with the work group, or more times for that matter. But I'm conscious there's a clock ticking on the time. The other option would be if this is close, and I've committed to working with it on the other side too, if this is of interest to the committee. I think we've made some substantial progress here, and we could continue working on it on the House side. Hoping to be either way.
Thank you. Joe, do you have anything?
Chairman, again, for the record, my name is Joe Brewer. Just some points of clarification with respect to the language requiring that all programs be assumed. There is no restriction in this language that would preclude contracting through intergovernmental agreement or with a third party to fill out a full menu of building inspection activity. We're currently in discussions with some folks from the Gorge area about contracting in a consortium to fill out a full service menu there. Regarding the certification issues, I would simply point out this is not a certification bill. It was never intended to be a I didn't believe it was intended to be a certification bill. It's a bill for licensing third-party providers, and I believe OBOA has its own bill in with respect to certification issues. The third party within 10 days, there is language in Section 23, Sub 3, that enables the jurisdiction to send a customer directly to a third-party provider. So in the case of Marion County's program, which I'm very familiar with, they run a very effective program. They could simply send that customer at the counter directly to a third-party provider. There was no intent on the in the language that I picked up to deal with special inspectors such as were spoken to, the concrete folks, so forth and so on. No desire to regulate them. That's why definitions around inspector and plan review were eliminated, so we're back to the original statutory language with respect to those areas. And finally, the local appeal process, I don't believe, is precluded. We would certainly not want building codes to deal with all the appeals that take place from local building official decisions. Trust me, that's not where the division would like to go either. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions.
Any questions from you?
Yes. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe, help me. I'm really confused on this. And like everyone else, just looking at the dash threes on Section 22, we just passed out Senate Bill 512. And the idea was to develop, as in Section 22, uniform processes for specialty codes, develop inspection standards that reflect regional needs, develop standard forms and procedures. I mean, And that was for metro area only, but this is now statewide. Is this over duplication of what we just talked about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzger, Senator Beyer and I had those discussions, and this really is the statewide platform for those issues. You're correct. Senate Bill 512 dealt with them in a metro region area, but these issues are germane to every contractor, every building department, every developer in the state. And I think that's what's being acknowledged here by the stakeholders that were at the table when we were in the work group, that these issues really do exist statewide. It isn't simply a Portland area problem. It's exacerbated in the metro area by the number of jurisdictions.
If I might address that.
Yeah, please.
I wouldn't say that this was it. I'd say they're complimentary, and it was intentional. In work groups, and Joe and I at some point talked about merging 512 and 587 together. There was enough interest and work that had been done in the 512 that we chose not to do that, recognizing that there would be some overlay. I don't think it competes or conflicts, but it's just there's a desire to have that committee in the regional area to sort of promote the inner workings and hopefully maybe driving an intergovernmental agreement there too. But I don't think there's anything in the dash threes or 587 that conflict with that at all. I don't think there is.
Okay.
At least that's not the intent as we put it together, and we try to be careful to make sure that didn't happen.
Can I ask one more question? Senator Byer asked of you, I'm just looking ahead here because we, in 512, we set up a board to set these standards for, you know, minor installation forms, and now we have, in this particular bill, DCBS is going to do that, and I just wondered if that might confuse the members as to what, you know, who's really necessary to do these things.
You'll notice in both cases that DCBS is issuing administrative rules. Mm-hmm. And I would suspect that the administrative rules were there, the issues over lay rules would likely to be exactly the same. Maybe they wouldn't duplicate their addresses, would be my guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The same people doing both sets.
Joe?
There are no questions.
I think we better be moving on here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank Senator Breyer for his work in doing all this. This is a very complicated issue. And I think it's probably the chair's position. I think we're going to try and move this amendment to move the bill and keep this process going, because we do have a time commitment. And I think Senator Breyer's made a commitment he would continue to work on this.
Mr. Chair, if that's your desire, I certainly agree with that. We'll continue to work with it. Sure. I would like to thank the people who came together. Not everybody had the same opinion, but I think we have a good faith effort to try and make some changes that would work, and we're trying to get everybody's input into the bill to do that. And I would express to those who just seen them, I apologize for that. That legislative council is pretty bogged down, and some of the language that came out is a little different than I would have liked to see it. And some of us sometimes have some differences of opinion on why attorneys write things the way they do, but we're working through those.
I hear Senator Byer move the DASRI amendment.
So moved.
Any comments, objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I would move Senate Bill 587 as amended to the floor with the DASRI.
So, Senator Byer's move 587 to the floor as amended to pass. Comments? Objections? So ordered. And Senator Byer.
Mm-hmm.
We'll love to carry that, I'm sure. And we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1115. Jack Roberts. Welcome in.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jack Roberts. I'm the commissioner of the Oregon Bureau of Labor and Industry. As you can see from the heading on the bill, there are a lot of people that are sponsoring this. I'm not one of them. I was actually asked to lead off here to give a little bit of background on how we got here, and then you will hear from a number of people testifying both for and against the bill. But I'll try to give as objective a history as I can as to how we are here and what I believe this bill involves before you hear some differing opinions on what desirability that might be. In 1997, the Oregon Court of Appeals, in a case by the name of Browder versus Oregon Roses, held that an employer who terminated agricultural workers who had met with a supervisor to complain about pay and working conditions violated the public policy set forth in ORS 662-020. 662-020 is a part of what we refer to as Oregon's Little North LaGuardia Act. The federal North LaGuardia Act was passed in 1932. It dealt with trying to stop the practice of courts issuing injunctions to prevent workers from operating together and whether unionizing or otherwise taking concerted action. The theory before that had been that this, in some cases, constituted a conspiracy, a criminal conspiracy, or strain of trade, and courts would often issue injunctions against workers. The North LaGuardia Act was intended to put a stop to that. And Oregon, the next year, in the 1933 session, adopted its own version of that. In doing so, in what is now ORS 662-020, they stated as a public policy a number of things that they believed were important and that were protected by the Act. Among them, if I can just quote a part of it, and I would urge any of you who are interested to read the entire section, but it talks about the public policy that the workers shall be free from the interference, restraint, or coercion of employers of labor or their agents, and the designation of such representatives or in self-organization, or, and this portion was in italics in the court decision, and other concerted activities for the purposes of collective bargaining or other mutual aid or protection. And the provision goes on, but it talks about the right of workers to come together and, in effect, petition their employer for redress of grievances on a concerted basis. The decision was by a three-judge panel, and the vote was 2-1, and it's now on appeal to the Oregon Supreme Court, and the Oregon Supreme Court has not yet ruled. They could do so any day now. They could do so some time from now. Last session, in an effort to overturn that decision, Senate Bill 1205 was written, and it was basically designed to simply say that ORS 662020 does not state any public policy that gives rise to a private right of action or otherwise give employees any rights. I oppose that measure, which I guess is why I got invited to come back here today, because while I personally believe that the Court of Appeals decision was wrong as a matter of law, and being a free country, we all have the right to an opinion, but also being a rule of law nation, my opinion didn't matter. And so I understood the reasons for wanting to change it, but felt that the factual situation in Oregon Roses was such that workers really were aggrieved. And if the legislature was going to take away the remedy provided by the court in this case, that some other protection should be provided. And I expressed that at the time. The House and Senate nonetheless passed the bill. The governor then vetoed it, expressing concerns similar to mine. In response to those concerns, you now have before you Senate Bill 1115, which, in essence, includes everything that was in 1205, but also includes Section 7, which says that it is an unlawful employment practice for an employer to discharge an individual employed in agricultural labor, as defined in ORS 657045, because the individual discusses or attempts to discuss wages or working conditions at a time and place and in a manner that does not disrupt work or constitute a slowdown, strike, or substantial job interruption. That language specifically addresses the concern that I raised in the last session. It does not address the full scope of what the Oregon Roses case means or reasonably interpreted to mean, and does not address the entire scope of activities that are listed in ORS 662020. That, I believe, is the basis for the discussion you're going to hear now. Those who believe that the Oregon Roses case and the decision at the Court of Appeals represented what is not only the law, but what should be the law, will not believe that this adequately addresses all that. Those who believe that Oregon Roses case was bad law, either because it's not a faithful interpretation of the original statute, or just simply think that it's too overreaching and that in effect prescribes some form of collective bargaining for agriculture, but who nonetheless believe that some protections for workers ought to be made available, would be in support of this. And that, I think, is the scope of the issue that is before you, is whether the remedy that is provided here under Section 7 is adequate and is fair. One thing that I would say, personally, as I mentioned, I believe that this bill addresses specifically my concern. The one thing that's not in the bill that I would recommend you look at if you go forward with it, this requires that, in this case, it was an unlawful employment practice, their exclusive remedy is to come to BOLI. They do not have a private right of action. I personally believe that they should have a private right of action in addition to coming to BOLI. That is true in other forms of unlawful employment practice, and we believe, my personal belief is, that should be provided. I understand there are alternative things that are maybe discussed or maybe presented to you, and we certainly would be glad to participate in that discussion. But I think I would be glad to answer questions. Otherwise, I think that it's probably appropriate then to hear from those who want to argue the adequacy or inadequacy of the remedy provided here.
Any questions? Thank you very much, John. And we have two panels, and we have about 45 minutes, 22 and a half minutes apiece. Is that we're giving everybody? Panel 2, Tim Beneskett, John McCullough, Tom Nelson. Chair, yeah. Okay, please, welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tim Bernafik. I'm the Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. To my right is Barry Beshu, the first Vice President of the Oregon Farm Bureau. Barry is also a nurseryman and a berry grower from Multnomah County. We are here in support of Senate Bill 1115, and I'd like to just very, very briefly express a few of my thoughts on the bill before allowing Barry to wrap up and present any views he may have. And we'd be more than happy to answer any questions. Since I agree, I think Commissioner Roberts presented a pretty fair representation of the issues and why we're all here. We do believe that the Rota versus Oregon Roses case is overreaching and carves a hole in Oregon's at-will employment law that needs to be remedied because it essentially opens the door to unionization activities on the farm, even though agriculture is specifically and expressly exempted from collective bargaining in ORS Chapter 663. One of the most troubling aspects of the Oregon Roses case is that the court took it upon itself to craft labor policy where it is actually the legislature's prerogative to do so. ORS Chapter 663 provides a framework for collective bargaining in the employment setting, and it expressly exempts agriculture from this process. And even though the legislature has decided that agricultural employers should not be subject to collective bargaining, the court ignored this express exemption and took it upon itself to make agricultural employers subject to collective bargaining. Whether or not agricultural employers should be subject to collective bargaining is a major public policy issue and should not be considered without public debate in the legislature. The court should be reminded, we feel, that it is the job of the legislature, not the court, to create a new policy. And that is one of the fundamental issues that we have with this court case. Commissioner Roberts was accurate that we presented Senate Bill 1205 midstream last session. The Court of Appeals decision that we found so troubling came down in the middle of March, so it was right in the middle of the session. We scrambled to get a bill together. We think it's a good bill. We still think it was a good bill, but after hearing some of the concerns from the other side and particularly the governor in his veto message, we think that he's right. Workers should not be discharged simply because they want to discuss concerns about wages and working conditions. No employer should be able to do that without facing some sort of penalty, and that's why we crafted Section 7 in this particular bill, and it provides for an unlawful employment practice for agricultural employers who discharge workers for discussing or attempting to discuss concerns about wages and working conditions, as long as such discussion does not constitute a work stoppage, strike, slowdown, or other substantial job interference. So the situation where a group of employees have concerns about the rate of pay or certain working conditions, and they bring that up to that employer, but are willing to go forward with the harvest or other work activities, and then they are discharged simply for raising those concerns, any agricultural employer should face penalties for doing so. But in a situation where those same two workers come to an agricultural employer and say, we are concerned about wages and working conditions, and we are going to sit here until you do something about that, that could interfere with the harvest and ability to get the crops in. That looks a lot more like a strike and certainly would be a substantial job interruption. And that's what agriculture, particularly in the harvest situation, cannot tolerate. And that's what our bill is provided. So, again, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions after Barry Beshu has a chance to present his testimony.
Barry?
Chairman Nelson and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to debate this subject with our colleagues and our friends here. I believe that the court usurped this opportunity when it made its decision out of hand. I am Barry Beshu. I'm a full-time farmer and first vice president of the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. I have come today to ask for your support for Senate Bill 1115. This proposed bill is a legislative fix to a court appeals decision in Rota versus Oregon Roses. With this decision, the court offset years of legislative intent and public debate used in crafting labor law. Senate Bill 1115 is similar to Senate Bill 1205, which was passed by the last legislature and then vetoed by the governor. Senate Bill 1115 addresses the governor's specific concerns and protects the rights of employees to discuss wages and working conditions without fear of reprisal, as long as there is no major disruption of work. Oregon Roses created a new cause of action for workers who are terminated for engaging in concerted activities. while concerted activities could be as innocent as simply raising concerns about wages and working conditions, it could be as serious as slowdowns, stoppages, strikes, or other activities in the workplace during harvest. Farmers should not be subject to a lawsuit for replacing workers who refuse to work during the harvest, but this is exactly what might happen if Oregon roses is not overruled. Raspberries are one of the commodities I raise. I have to harvest them within 24 hours of ripening, or I lose them. A work stoppage would devastate me. I have lost money for the last 2 years on raspberries due to low prices and weather. If I can't get them picked, it would bankrupt me. Agriculture is in crisis nationwide. Cheap imports, low prices, high costs, and over-regulation are making it ever more difficult to provide food economically. We value our employees, and we recognize their importance to our farming operations. However, we must be able to make money, or we will be out of business and unable to employ anyone. We see reports in the media which relegate farmers to the status of swine. We are blamed for everything from the decimation of salmon to poisoning children. We are less than 2% of the population and an easy target. The reality is that we are generally family-oriented, small business people trying to make a living. My greatest personal fear, I'm a third-generation farmer in the Multnomah County area, my greatest personal fear is to have to go to my father and tell him that I've lost the farm, after two generations before me have been able to maintain it. Perhaps your greatest concern as a government ought to be the ability of agriculture to maintain a viable economic force in the state of Oregon. We are not perfect as farmers, but for the most part work hard and try to comply with the myriad laws and regulations governing our industry. These laws should be written by legislators and not courts. Senate Bill 1115 would right that wrong. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions?
Just a question that was brought up by Mr. Roberts. He was suggesting, it has been suggested that one of the deficits of the bill is that it does not allow for a private right of action for the language that you have in the bill. Do you feel, do you share that concern? I mean, is that something that you are receptive to?
Well,
other than just the Bureau of Labor and Industries?
Sure, Nelson, Senator Metzger. The reason that we have it crafted that way is that we would rather have any concerns about retaliation or discharge for engaging in these concerted activities, we would rather route that through BOLI, through their administrative process. We feel that it is a cheaper way of resolving the issue. And the real heart or the nub of this case and, or this issue and other cases that the Oregon farmers face is that although legal services or the Oregon Law Center provides a very valuable service for the workers, the agricultural workers in the state, a group of people that do not have the financial ability to oftentimes seek justice, and we certainly would not want to take that away from them. The problem with lengthy protracted court actions is that farmers don't have that same, don't have an Oregon Law Center to turn to pay their legal bills. And so we have a lot of farmers in Oregon that just to get through the first phase of litigation spend upwards of $70,000 just to defend themselves to prove they haven't done anything wrong. We would rather, when we're faced with the situation that it's simply agricultural employers and agricultural workers, where you've got an Oregon Law Center and then you've got the farmers, we would rather have that in some contained setting in the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And that's where we are now. That's why we've crafted it the way it is.
Very good. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Before we Senator Castillo, would you like to come forth and welcome to the committee. Thank you. I suppose you have a committee meeting someplace else, do you?
I do. Thank
you. Keep you waiting.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I come in opposition to Senate Bill 1115. For the record, Susan Castillo, State Senator, District 20 from Eugene. I have some concerns. I was listening to the testimony here and do share the concerns that our labor commissioner has already expressed about the lack of inclusion of the private right of action in this bill. And I just have a concern about this bill going the opposite direction of what I feel we need to be doing in the area of farm worker labor law. It seems to me that this is a group of workers that really, based on all the information we've been hearing over the course of, for some time now, needs more protections, not less. And this bill, I think, does offer rolling back protections that that we have. I wanted to say that I very much support our ag industry being as successful as it possibly can be, because it is very important to the economy of our state. And I in no way want to create obstacles for that industry, because we know how important it is and we need for them to be successful. However, what we're talking about here is the ability to enforce laws that are on the books in terms of protections for workers. And I don't think that asking people, that creating protections to make sure that people adhere to the law has anything to do with creating obstacles for farmers. The vast majority of farmers, I believe, do make a very good effort to obey all of our labor laws and treat their workers well. The penalties and any kinds of laws that we would have on the books that would deal with violations are going to be dealing with people who are breaking the law, and those are the folks that we're concerned about, not the vast majority of farmers who are out there doing a great job, working really hard, and treating their people very well. So I did want to say that. But I'm just very concerned that based on a hearing that we had last fall, there were a number of legislators that had an informational hearing and heard about a number of problems that farm workers are facing today, whether it be with housing or problems with enforcement of minimum wage, and their fear of complaining, the workforce that doesn't come forward and complain out of concerns about either not understanding what our laws are or fear of retaliation. It just seems to me that, that rolling back protections is just going in the wrong direction, and I just ask for your serious consideration as people do come forward and talk about their concerns about this workforce. And also, I did want to express an interest in seeing if there's any way that we can still get the parties to continue to work on trying to come to some kind of a compromise on this bill. That would be the ultimate goal here. I know we did have a meeting yesterday, and there were some good discussions. At the end of that meeting, people still seem to be in separate corners on this issue, but if there still is an opportunity for us to continue to talk and try and find some common ground here, I would very much appreciate that opportunity as well. So, thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Questions? Well, appreciate your coming.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. John and Tom?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the community. I'm John McCulley, representing the Tree Fruit Growers. That's a coalition of grower and shipper organizations in the Mid-Columbia, Hood River, Wasco counties, Milton, Freewater, and Jackson County parts of the state. We're here in support of Senate Bill 1115, and for the reasons that you have heard from the previous witnesses, Mr. Bernastic and Mr. Bashu, and so we won't duplicate their testimony. I just think the critical issues that we see are, number one, the concern about the public policy that's been set by the Court of Appeals rather than the legislature. I think that's a fundamental issue that we need to address in the legislature. If there are going to be changes in the way agriculture is treated relative to collective bargaining, that needs to come from the legislature and not from the court. As well, we are concerned about potential work stoppages and slowdowns during critical times of production, especially during harvest. In the fruit industry, we have those times as well. Maybe not as critical as a 24-hour period on raspberries, but when cherries are ready to pick and when pears are ready to pick, they have to be taken care of. And so it's very critical that those crops be taken care of at that time. The new language that has been added to the bill to specifically address the governor's veto message is supported by us. We think that is an acceptable way to go and appropriate. And we believe it's a good faith effort on the part of the industry to show a willingness to address the issues that the governor raised when he vetoed Senate Bill 1205 last session. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll let Mr. Nelson make any comments he would like to make.
Welcome, Tom. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Tom Nelson, the Executive Director of the Hood River Grower Shipper Association, Hood River. It's 280 growers, about 15,000 acres of pears, little apples, and some cherries, but we're 90% pears. People still think of apples, and the blossom weekend is this weekend. There are some blossoms, but they're not too big yet, but they're growing. Our industry is very interested in this bill. We would have had some growers come down, but they've had some long nights the last few nights with the wind machines and some heating, and then in the morning they get out in the orchards and are doing their orchard practices, so it's a little bit tight. And actually, they're a little cranky right now, and I didn't want to ask too many to come down. But Senate Bill 1115 is an important bill to our industry. We watch this very closely, very carefully. Our industry does agree that workers should have the right to discuss wages and working conditions without being fired for those discussions, short of major work disruption. I think one of the issues that agriculture has, and I don't know if we do it to ourselves or whatever, but we had a lot of attention the last year, particularly in the Oregonian, and we sort of sometimes feel like we're coming out of a hole. The majority of the growers are good growers. They have good labor practices. They treat workers with respect. They have good communication. But in any industry, there's some problem areas out there. And I think on the advocate standpoint, they need to identify those problem areas and go to the agencies and put pressure on them instead of keep bringing them up to our light. In our own industry, we don't support people that don't have good labor practices. I think that one of the issues we're talking about now is the civil action. In an industry where you can have a lot of technicalities, if you look at the roses instance, I'm sure the people that have the company the roses, what they did, they thought perhaps it was legal to do, or they thought they were within the law, and then obviously they were found not to. Well, they've spent a lot of money to get to this point, and it kind of makes you a little nervous as a farmer. So you're trying to, in a sense, frame the labor law so you understand them. You know, we don't have human resources departments. We don't have people that go to two seminars a year to get the latest angles. And so you have to kind of, you know, a farmer has to be careful. And he just kind of wants it pretty simple and wants to know what it is. And I think a farmer can convey that to the workers pretty adequately. But a civil right of action is in the law. And if someone does something wrong, they should be punished for it. And we've got some nice civil actions. There's some, they have to pay the wages. They have to make it right. And that should be it and go on. I know in Orosha, if something is wrong in Orosha, generally Orosha is into compliance more than punishment. And I think the attitude that agriculture has is we'd like to be in compliance and not punishment. And I think by going with the civil right of action, an employer has to make it right. That's number one, because it should be made right. But the person doesn't necessarily need to be punished for it, because it in a sense becomes a win-win. The employer learns something, the employee's needs are taken care of, and hopefully everything goes on well. But we support the bill as it is, and would like to see it pass.
Thank you. Questions?
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you very much. We have D. Michael Dale, and Roland Ramirez, and Ginny Berg. Welcome.
Thank you, sir.
Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, my name is Michael Dale. I'm an attorney with the Oregon Law Center, and I represented the workers in the Oregon Roses case. And I'm here today to give you a little bit of the history of this issue, but also to urge that you not support Senate Bill 1115. Commissioner Roberts gave you some of the background of the Oregon Roses case. I just want to take a minute or two more to maybe talk about a little bit of the facts behind the case, because I think it sort of helps to show what motivated the court. And basically what happened in the Oregon Roses case was that you had some workers that were picking the greenery that goes around roses when they're packed. and they were picking that greenery and had for years on an hourly basis. Their employer unilaterally changed that to a piece rate basis. In other words, they would be paid by how much they pick, how fast they pick. And this was explained to them as being a real advantage to them, that they'd make a lot more money and they would really like it. Well, they went out and tried it for a while and they didn't like it, and actually their wage rate fell by about 25%. And when you're a very low-income worker anyway, having a 25% decline in wages is really very, very serious. And so, naively, they thought, well, you know, that fellow said we would like it. Maybe if we get him back down here and have another meeting, we can explain to him we don't like it, and he'll change it back to the way it's always been. And so they asked for such a meeting. There was a meeting, and a fairly extended discussion occurred. It occurred, this isn't in the court opinion, but I think it's significant here, it occurred at the plant on company time. And basically what happened by the end of the meeting was that each of the workers agreed with the manager that they would continue work for another 3 weeks at the employer's wages and working conditions, right? In other words, on the piece rate basis. They'd try it for another 3 weeks, and then they would talk again to see if their wages had come up during that period of time. Then the manager went back to his office and he wrote a memo to the file, and he said this crew is no longer a useful crew to Oregon Roses because they think they're a union or something. And I would have fired them on the spot, but it was a Friday and he couldn't get the payroll cut that day, and he had a shipment that needed to go out over the weekend, and he couldn't get replacement workers arranged that quickly, so he basically had them work through the weekend, which they did without incident. And on Monday morning, everyone who had come to the original meeting was fired, flat fired, including two women who went to the meeting not because they weren't even affected by the change in piece rate. They only went to the meeting because they spoke better English than their coworkers, and they were there to help them explain what their position was and why they were concerned about that. They were fired, too. They were fired, too. They were all fired. And, of course, for any other worker in our workforce, this would be a clear violation of the National Labor Relations Act or Oregon's labor relations law under Chapter 663. However, farm workers are exempt, as has been stated, from those provisions. However, there is another law, and the Court of Appeals didn't make this law up. This body passed a law in 1933, and that law said it is the policy of the state of Oregon that, and I'm skipping some words, but the operative words are that it is necessary that workers have the right to engage in collective activity for mutual aid and protection. And the court looked at that policy and it says, how are we going to effectuate this policy when we have a situation where workers were doing exactly that and are fired for exercising the very right that the Oregon legislature had said it is necessary that they have? And the court says, well, there has to be a remedy. The Oregon Constitution says for every wrong there has to be a remedy. And so the court says there must be a remedy, and the remedy is that these workers can sue. This isn't novel stuff. Ever since 1975, the Oregon Supreme Court has said that when a worker is fired for engaging in activity that is protected under important public policies, that worker has a right to sue. If he doesn't otherwise have a right that's granted by statute, has a right to sue for wrongful discharge. That's true for taking time off to go to jury duty, for making a workers' comp complaint, for refusing to lie about other employees in a job recommendation. In a number of other areas, the court has said that if it violates public policy, that's the limit of at-will employment. And they just said this in the same way. They looked at the statutes, and they looked at 60 years of court decisions and other policies that are otherwhere in the statute, and they said, yeah, we think that's the policy, that's the stated legislative policy adopted by this body, and we have to effectuate that policy. And that's what the Oregon Roses decision did. Now, I would say that if that's wrong, the Oregon Supreme Court has an opportunity to correct it. And I wish they'd done it by now. Obviously, decided one way or the other.
Not everybody's mind.
but someday I suppose that will happen. But we believe it is the correct interpretation of the law. It's consistent, by the way, with what the state of Washington has done based upon a very similar policy. And their Supreme Court has acted on it. And by the way, agriculture in Washington seems to be thriving, and the cherries aren't rotting, and the raspberries aren't failing to get harvested. Things seem to be going well for agriculture in Washington, and they live with us quite well. And in fact, I would say, in 1997, when we came here, there were going to be spates of lawsuits, and there was going to be rotting fruit. And we're 2 years later, and there is, to my knowledge, one other case that's been in litigation in that 2 years. I think anybody in the state would know about it. I would, and I think that's the only case there is. It hasn't presented the major problem that it was proposed to be. Now, what's wrong with this bill that they propose to recognize the Oregon Roses case? And there are basically two fundamental problems that we have with it. The first is the scope of protection is far too narrow and too limited. This bill would not have protected the Oregon Roses workers. Because when they asked for that meeting with the employer, they caused an interruption of work. It was substantial. It was a lengthy meeting, a couple, 3 hours, if I remember. They wouldn't be protected by this. Someone who went to a farm and wore a cocoon button and was fired for it would not be protected under this bill. Someone who went and, among other workers, said, "You know, we should talk to the boss about this new piece rate system. We don't like it very much," but hadn't spoken to the employer yet. That person would not be protected under this bill. So the scope of protection is far too limited. Secondly, it's been referred to, the remedy is very limited. BOLI has very, very limited staff. They take a very, very few of the cases that come to them, and they cream the cases. They take the cases where there's a smoking gun, it's a lay-down case. And the rest of the cases, they pass on to private attorneys to bring in the courts to the private right to sue. That's the whole overwhelming pattern. Here we would not have that right. And so essentially we would be stuck with whatever Boley decided about the case, and these cases are ones that are inevitably a he said, she said kind of case where there isn't a smoking gun. Well, not always. Sometimes somebody goes back and writes a memo that says these people are acting like a union, but I suspect that won't happen again. So we have some real problems with this legislation as it's written. Now, we want to be responsive to the criticism that says that the legislature should make law and not the courts. As I said, I don't think the courts made law. The courts interpreted the law that the legislature made. Notwithstanding, it does seem to me it would be to the interest of all the parties to have greater certainty in this area. And we have proposed to agriculture a bill in lieu of this which would answer many of their problems. That legislation that we've offered and the union supports it, labor supports it, would do several things. It would make it clear that farmers could lawfully replace workers that are striking. That's one of the things you heard. It would allow firing of workers who assault others or threaten, interfere with farm employees or who destroy property in the farm or block entrance or exits to the farm. You fire those workers. It would also clarify the normal non-retaliatory discipline of employees was permitted. It would provide that employers need not bargain in good faith as is required under the collective bargaining statute. There's no obligation that you would bargain in good faith with the employees. You could if you wanted to. If you didn't want to, you didn't have to talk to them. You would not have to recognize their union as a bargaining agent. And it would specifically allow employers to make their normal job assignments according to the normal business practices, regardless of whether workers have engaged in collective activity or not. Now, my written testimony has said that the Farm Bureau has flatly turned us down in this proposal. I'm happy to report that we've had some discussions this morning that indicate that perhaps there is some chance of some movement in positions that give us some hope that perhaps we can get closer and reach some kind of agreement that we could bring to the committee Obviously, these are complex issues about which people feel deeply, and we just haven't had the time, I think, in either community to really digest some of the ideas and figure out whether everybody's second choice they really could live with or not, and we'll need some additional time to figure that out. And perhaps we can, in the next several weeks, be able to come up with something that would be a consensus bill. As this bill is now, we would not support it. We would urge your opposition to it. The governor has said publicly that if the legislature passes Senate Bill 1205 over again, that he will veto it again. This bill is offered as something different enough that it's not the same bill. We will do everything in our power, because we feel it is the same bill. We will do everything in our power to persuade the governor to oppose it, and we believe that we can have success in that. I might add that in my prepared comments, I ended, we urge your opposition to Senate Bill 1205. That was a kind of a Freudian slip, but actually that's really what I mean. This is 1205, and we urge that you oppose Senate Bill 1205. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Okay. How do you feel about Spectrum 7? I think that Mr. Roberts testified to that somebody did along the line. Is that Spectrum was put in specifically answering the governor's reasons for vetoing the 1205?
Senator Nelson, it responds only to the very worst case scenario and does it inadequately. It, as I said, it would not have protected the Oregon Roses workers. And if it did protect the Oregon Roses workers, they would not have had an effective remedy, because they would have gone to Boley, where probably their case would have been kicked because it wasn't one of the ones with the smoking gun. And they would have no recourse to the courts. And that's unfair. That's fundamentally unfair.
Questions?
Yes. Michael, on that Section 7, if you get down to line 16 and go down to what says, or working conditions, and put a period there, does that change anything?
Well, it changes quite a bit. Actually, that's quite a bit more favorable. It would still only protect persons who discusses or attempts to discuss wages or working conditions. So the guy who wore a Pecun pin on his lapel wouldn't be protected, even then.
Other questions?
It obviously would be helpful in broadening the scope.
Okay. We're a little under time, but I don't know if you can summarize your
I'll be very short.
Testament, that would be very good.
Thank you.
I want to give you an opportunity to speak as long as you...
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeannie Berg-Rumpel, and I represent the Oregon State Council of Service Employees. We represent 28,000 public and private sector employees in Oregon. And we strongly oppose Senate Bill 1115. We oppose it because it does limit the right of farm workers to be free from retaliation by their employers for engaging in collective activity. We believe that the right to engage in some form of collective activity to address wages and working conditions is a fundamental right of all employees and should remain that. I also think that Senate Bill 1115 is deceptive, and that it appears to sort of protect some rights, but the intention of it was really to not protect these, you know, to take these workers out of protection. And, you know, by changing what happened in the Roses case. And so, for those reasons, we oppose it. And I do think that the right of workers to sue in response to wrongful discharge is something that should be the right of all workers, including farm workers. I don't know how much I can add to what Michael said. He's sort of the expert on this. And I don't know how often I can reiterate how important the right to collective activity is. I think that's what secured many of what our basic rights to workers over the years. Things like the 40-hour week, the 8-hour day. And so we take that very seriously. Any rolling back of the right to collective activity.
Questions? Thank you. Ramon, please introduce yourself. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Ramon Ramirez. I'm the president of Oregon Farm Worker Union, PECUN, and on behalf of our 4,500 members, we wish to express our strong opposition to Senate Bill 1115. We're totally opposed to it. Currently in the state of Oregon, farm workers are not covered by the National Labor Relations Act. So, because of that, I feel that, workers have had little protection. And that as a result of that, farm workers continue to live in substandard conditions. I mean, we bought a labor camp out here, just to give you an idea, last month. About what it's like to live in housing that's not even fit for a dog. We earn low wages. And then when workers complain, the standard practice is, get out of my farm. I don't want you here. You're a troublemaker, right? I mean, that's a prevailing standard around here. I know that there are some growers that don't do that, but a lot do. And I think that many farm workers are willing to talk to their employers about issues in the workplace or about resolving problems, but I think that many are afraid to do that because of retaliation. While existing law makes most employment retaliation illegal, I think many farm workers have been victims of this. And I think, I think Senate Bill 1115 is an attempt to undermine the little protections that farm workers will enjoy under the Lauda versus, Oregon Roses case. But I really think that for us farm workers, it doesn't really make a difference in the end if it's the legislature that makes the decision or it's the courts that make the decision. But that we correct that, that we give more protection to farm workers because we don't got it. I mean, if you take Oregon statutes and you look at it, every single statute that deals with worker protection, there's always an exemption for agriculture. And I think it's about time we start examining, what the long range effects these exemptions are having on farm workers, right? And not only on farm workers, but in the general community. I think it's absurd to say that this bill or private right of action or the Lauda versus Oregon Roses will lead to collective bargaining. And we're not talking about collective bargaining. Believe me, we're not talking about collective bargaining. I know because our union right now has signed 4 collective bargaining agreements with growers, right? And we know the dynamics there. We can sit down with our growers and talk about differences, right? And we've done it without a state law, right? Because farm workers are excluded from the National Labor Relations Act. So we know that we are able to, we know what it's like to deal with problems in the workplace. And to do it in an atmosphere where retaliation isn't an issue. Because we have a retaliation clause in our contract. We're working, and we have a really good relationship with the growers that we have signed up with. So this is not about collective bargaining, believe us. It's about basic, fundamental rights, right? The right to just, a group of workers to talk about what the wages are going to be, right? And the standard or the prevailing practice now, and our union, we just covered the Northern Willamette Valley, right? The standard practice is that you complain, you're gone. That's the bottom line. I think that that farm workers' rights need to be, in Oregon, need to be respected. I think that contrary to what people are saying, farm workers have made Oregon agriculture very, very successful. Very successful. In fact, if you look at the last 3 publications of the Department of Agricultural Statistics in terms of gate sales in the state of Oregon, you'll find that there's been a huge increase over the last several years. So we're making farm workers are making Oregon productive, and we need respect. I think You know, we need to be, farm workers need to be treated, you know, we're not asking for that we be treated any, you know, special than anybody else, that we're just afforded the rights and the respect that every other worker in this state enjoy already. That's what we're asking for. And to me, it seems, it's really difficult for me to sit here and reflect that we are still dealing with conditions, that are similar to apartheid in South Africa. And apartheid in South Africa has already been dismantled. So why can't we do the same here? I'll cut it here. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Brad Witt, Alan Lowell, Gary Bishaw here. Welcome, and please introduce yourself, and we're a little bit under some time constraint, but if you could summarize your testimony, I'd certainly appreciate it.
I will attempt to do that, Mr. Chairman. My name is Brad Witt. I'm Secretary-Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and appearing before you this afternoon in opposition to Senate Bill 1115. This is a bill that purports to add protections for farm workers, but actually takes them away. Point number one, if farm workers enter into discussions with their employer regarding wages and working conditions, and those discussions happen to inconvenience the employer, which is to say it would disrupt the work, then those farm workers lose the protections for peaceful activities which they currently enjoy under current Oregon statute. Secondly, as you have already heard, this bill eliminates farm workers who have been terminated for the unlawful employment practices that are outlined in Section 7, eliminates their right to sue in court. We also have problems with the bill addressing only individual activity. And presumably, this individual activity is at the expense of concerted activity. And I would like to give you an example here of one of the problems that we see developing with respect to Section 7. Let's presume that we have a group of farm workers that has a problem with wages or working conditions and goes to the employer as a group to express those concerns and or problems. That group has a spokesperson or persons, of which perhaps I am not one of them. I am not one of the spokespersons. With a literal interpretation of this bill as written, I'm not certain that I have any protections afforded me as a member of that group. In fact, I don't think I have any. And I think those in that group who are not spokespersons could be summarily terminated. So for all those reasons, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we urge your opposition to this bill, would encourage attempts, as you have heard earlier today, from representatives of Cocoon some kind of arrangement be made to work out the differences of this bill. And I would like to add just one additional comment. Prior to coming to my current job, I was a representative of seafood workers. I was a seafood union representative. And the product, of course, was fish. Not unlike, I think, produce, which has the chance, perhaps, of very rapid diminishing of its value, very perishable product. Fish was the same way, particularly when the product in the totes was delivered on the docks in the summertime. You have a very short amount of time in which to process that product. As I say, I think not unlike produce. My members
chose not to strike during those occasions that the product was delivered to dock and when it had to be processed very quickly for a very good reason. Certainly they could have their employer in a bind, but they didn't. Not only is the employer in bind, but so are the workers if they choose to strike, because that is their opportunity to obtain their wage. And in both instances, the people I represented, and presumably in agriculture as well, they were not high-wage, high-skilled jobs, and those folks needed the work. And so it was a major consideration of theirs that they not strike and that they have that work to the greatest extent available. So, Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony, and I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lowe?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe. I'm Director of Public Policy for Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon. And I'll just, I guess, very quickly say that we really do concur with the analysis that was prepared for you by Michael Dale from the Oregon Law Center. We do believe that Senate Bill 1115, as it appears before you today, is a taking. It's a taking of existing rights of those who work the land. We also believe that it proposes a remedy really before the final diagnosis is in. We're still awaiting the ruling from the Supreme Court. And so we would suggest that a legislative response to the Court of Appeals decision really is premature. We do respectfully request that you reject Senate Bill 1115 as it appears before you today, and we would ask that you do pursue the kind of legislation which Michael Dale discussed, and that is non-retaliatory language. Farm workers live in a great deal of fear, and we have a responsibility, we believe, to limit the reasons for their fear. I'd be happy to respond to
you. Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? Senator George, are you, did you intend to testify? Just hearing you waiting for the next year. You're in the transportation committee. Okay, I'm just checking. We do have another committee meeting coming in here. Thank you very much for your testimony. I guess I'll just have to close this public hearing and we don't have all of our members here. So any other business coming for this committee? That one. Maybe, yeah.
All right.
We have to have it before
the 30th.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And,